Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
Danielle, I just noticed Bitcoin, $3,000 drop at least today. What's going on in the cryptocurrency corner?
Well, it's like a good old fashioned bank run that's happening on the crypto space. It's been a gong show of the Wild West for the last few years, especially since the pandemic, when liquidity was flowing from fiscal and monetary injections and everyone had spare time, and it really became a major preoccupation of the populace. And what happened was people were doubling down and, throwing money at things without any real clear sense of what or why or, what the return prospects, if any, there were. So everything, I called it the everything bubble then. It's the everything bust now. So it's very contagious because there's so much leverage. And when I say leverage, I don't know if people finally appreciate the amount of what I mean by that being borrowing against one thing to buy something else. And then that, then borrowing against that second asset to buy something else, and then borrowing against that to buy something else. So there's just this daisy chain of debacle all around, because what happens when the base rate in the banking system, quadruples in record time as it has year to date, all of a sudden everything that made, no sense at zero rates or, barely made any sort of, you could barely make an argument for why it might have a return at zero rates, has really gone upside down at the highest rates since, the highest base rates in the banking system since 2007. So, a lot of people were, it's like the tulip mania all over again. They were basically making up tokens, in the crypto space, buying each other with these made up tokens, which, they imbued with value just because they said so. And then if they had enough believers, people would buy it and bid it up, kind of like real estate, the doubling of housing prices that happened in many parts of Canada in the couple of years, before 2022, it was, still just the same house, but suddenly people were paying ridiculous amounts for it, all because rates were so low that they thought that made sense. So it's all sort of upside down now. And as I say, when you get sort of someone blinks, and, crypto is a full-on Ponzi scheme in many ways. Like, there's no actual underlying asset of any kind. At least with a house, there's a house, and hopefully you can live in it if you don't lose it to the bank. Mm. But with crypto, there's just, like, really sketchy, logic or argument about why a token is worth X versus another token. And as I say, they all went up in an incredible bubble between 2019 and 2022. And now you've got the fastest monetary tightening cycle in history. You've got all this liquidity coming out. You've got stress in the consumer sector, huge because of the high rates and the high inflation on food and energy. And all of a sudden, people are literally having to spend their entire, for example, paycheck just to try and cover the mortgage. I see that anecdotally. I see that in actual data. The homeowners petition in Canada, that was exactly their point. They're saying, oh, look, now we're having to pay all of our income to just kind of cover this one debt payment. So anyway, back to crypto, we had the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange, which is this, again, this platform that was that people could trade these different tokens on, was asked to bail out the second largest one, because it had basically a liquidity crunch. It had people wanted cash, because ultimately that's what all these tokens and assets are all only valued, to the extent they can be swapped for actual cash. Cash in the sense of what you pay your bills in, right? What you buy food with, what you pay your heat in, and all that sort of thing. So it's the currency that you pay your bills in, which is actually the asset that you need. And so all these other derivatives, when you put that cash into all these other derivatives, whether it's the stock market, corporate debt, you know, fungible tokens, cryptocurrencies, all these things, you're doing so with no actual fundamental benefit in that asset itself. The only thing you're doing is speculating that it will go up in value or be a store of value of some kind, so that when you want to get cash back, you'll be able to quickly swap that for the cash of your bills. And so what happened in this case is that the tokens involved basically were put for sale, or were coming for sale, and there were no bidders. And so ultimately, again, when there's no bidders and there's only people looking to sell, price crashes. And once that starts to crash, I mean, you're talking about an asset, in the case of this FTX, the second largest crypto exchange in the world, that had a notional market value of $32 billion like 2 days ago. And today that notional value is about zero. Just because, again, it's like somebody called the bluff and said, okay, I'd like the cash, please. And, you know, this is the same in the banking system, right? We know that there is not enough cash in the vault of any bank that you deal with, that if everyone wanted to have to cash out the credits in their bank accounts, there wouldn't be enough cash for everyone to have. Now, in the banking system, we've learned through centuries of crisis and bank runs and liquidity crunches that there has to be a process of segregation of client assets. So when you put money in your bank accounts, it's not supposed to be commingled with the assets of the bank. And there's ratios and requirements, and there's a lot of safety stuff that's been put in place to try and prevent this kind of catastrophic loss for deposit owners or people who have funds in the institution. In crypto, there really isn't any of that. Again, it's a fairly nascent sector. It's only been around about a decade, right? So, I mean, Bitcoin originally started in 2008, but so essentially it's only known an upcycle, right? Because we had this very extended upcycle because of all the QE, because of all the zero rate policies, because of all the repeated interventions by central banks and fiscal stimulus from governments. We really have had this bull market run that continued from the bottom in 2009 all the way through. And many of the managers of companies today, as well as so-called money managers, have never actually seen a period where there was a restriction on liquidity or where capital was coming out of the system. They've only known a system that was flooded with capital, right? So you see that in all kinds of business models, where they haven't got a clue how to manage this kind of an environment. They were, you know, risk long on every possible asset and thinking they were diversified, which was a complete farce, because again, it all went up at the same time, which tells you that all these things can come down at the same time. And as soon as someone starts needing liquidity to pay off a bill in the currency of their liability, and they, you know, go to try and sell an asset to get that cash, as soon as there's a problem or constriction on that ability to get cash, they look at something else they can sell, and they get margin calls, because a lot of them were borrowing against their portfolios to buy other things, to spend, to buy art, to buy, you know, God knows what, everything except cash in this environment, where all the, you know, the people looking to sell us things were telling us cash was trash. You know, the Ray Dalios of the world, who was trying to sell his fund, telling everyone cash is trash, you got to get rid of that, you got to exchange it like a hot potato for anything and everything without any regard for whether there's any value in the thing you're exchanging it for. So this is what we've been in for the past many years. And now, as I say, the dawn has broken, that these things are only as good as they're exchangeable for liquidity and cash, and that's what everyone's short on today, whether you're the Bank of Japan, who, you know, is selling U.S. treasuries, not because they don't want to have U.S. treasuries, but because they're trying to support their currency in yen, and they need actual yen to purchase their own treasuries and to support their own currency, because they're looking at this, you know, huge inflationary impacts of a higher U.S. dollar. So there's a whole bunch of places in the world where you've got this high dollar, you've got collapsing export revenue, you've got a cash crunch because a lot of foolish things were done with money during this period that I've described. And so everyone's desperate for trying to support their currency, trying to get more of that. And they're selling all sorts of things, anything and everything, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, basically, is all on sale in this environment. And frankly, I think we've only really got started here, which is the really amazing thing. So the stress that people are noting already, you know, we're back to sort of November 2020 levels on many things, like Bitcoin's just one of them, but many stocks that were the darlings, where, you know, the fangs and everybody thought they could do no wrong, a lot of them have already given up back to where they were in 2020. But if you look at their progression or price points before all this mania broke out in full, you know, their price could go down another 50% and more and still just get back to sort of support before the brain fever took over, if you will. So I think you can see another, you know, 6 to 12 months of forced selling in asset markets. And I think at that point, we should get some really awesome opportunities for people that have retained their cash and liquidity. But unfortunately, that's not most people.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, what's happening with all these people and corporations that snapped up houses sight unseen with plans to rent them out themselves or through Airbnb?
Well, it's the same thing, right? It's part and parcel of the same thing. A lot of people who had zero experience with being a landlord or maintaining a property, you know, bought through whatever cash and whatever debt they could borrow into this asset class, thinking that, you know, housing only goes up. How many times have we heard this? This is like, I swear Canadians missed entirely The Big Short, the movie The Big Short, which won the Oscar. I think it was in 2016 or 17 in there. You know, they honestly didn't watch it, apparently, because we've lived it in full in Canada the past few years, but not just in Canada. In America, too, they really went back to many of the same destructive habits that they did in the last housing bubble and then bust. But basically, people just threw money at real estate thinking you could never go wrong, it will never go down, it'll never get cheaper, you know, all that, which has always been wrong, but that's the thinking that was widely held. And so for example, in the clampdown, you know, when rates went to nearly zero, when mortgage rates were less than 2%, and everyone was being, you know, thinking that they were all leaving the cities and they all wanted second houses and all this sort of thing, we had a huge amount. I think it's something like 40% based, depending on the area, but in general, in Canada and America, in the 2020 to 22 period, 40% of the houses were bought not as a primary residence, right? So as a vacation home for yourself, or people thought they could rent them out to other people. And they were basing that on these, you know, extraordinarily low interest rates, in many cases floating rate mortgages, where they were basically just covering the interest payment. And even in that scenario, a lot of these properties were not breaking even or had negative carry, but people thought, oh, that's okay, if we have to subsidize it a bit, the asset's going to go up X over this period of time. So the data is actually amazing. 62% of the houses that were listed for short-term rental on Airbnb, which is one of these, you know, short-term rental sites where they're not looking for full-time tenants, they're looking for people who want to periodically come to town, whether it's for work or for vacation or pleasure, and they're fully furnished, and you come in, and the rents charged, of course, for short-term are much higher than you could get from a regular, if a person was to lock in for a 12-month lease, you have a more consistent cash flow or guaranteed cash flow, so to speak, but you have a lower rate. So a lot of people were like, well, who wants to have a long-term tenant and the Landlord and Tenant Act and all the problems you can potentially have if they don't pay and having to get them out, when you can go with an Airbnb or a VRBO or any of these services that you people could book your place for short-term rentals. So 62% of the properties in the U.S. that were added in the from 2020 to 22 were in these short-term situations where people had bought them for that purpose. And then, of course, what's happened year-to-date is that the mortgage rates have leapt through the ceiling along with utility costs, as well as many municipalities, including where I live, have brought in restrictions on the amount of rent, the time amount you can rent these properties for. In other words, in the jurisdiction where I live, it has to be more than 30 days now because they were having so much complaints about short-term rentals being so disruptive and inattentive landlords and, you know, people wreaking havoc on communities and neighborhoods. And so there's been a lot of negative press and outcomes around this particular activity. So you have this curtailment of how much it can be rented at the same time that you have an explosion in costs and in supply, at the same time that you have now a consumer-led downturn in the economy. So bookings are evaporating. A lot of people were, you know, are holding these properties they can't now fund out of their own incomes. They can't service the obligations around them. And they're, you know, desperately looking for either to add them to the long-term rental pool, which is, you know, which is great because we have had a lot of rental inflation in the past couple of years, and we do need more long-term rental supply to help water down that and bring the cost of living down for renters. So that's all positive. The tricky bit is, of course, for the owners, the rate, as I said, the yield, the rental yield is much lower on these long-term leases than it is on the short-term. And many of them are just not able to make that turn fast enough. In other words, they're already underwater and not able to meet the commitments on their debt on those properties. So the other thing that's happening, and it will take some time here because it doesn't, real estate doesn't turn on a dime. People don't instantly say, oh, you know, we need to sell this. They usually have a period of denial or funding it from lines of credit or, you know, we've seen a huge spike in credit card use and lots of lines of credit in Canada and America. Anyway, so there's a period of time it takes, but eventually these properties will either come back on the housing market for sale as people, again, the cash crunch spreads, people need money to pay bills. So they will be listing these properties, which ultimately will help again bring down the price of real estate. Which is all positive because it was too high to begin with, but it is going to be a self-propelling force. Just as all this free money and gobbling up properties without any math-based calculations was a force that drove up prices way longer than farther than they should have, the reverse is also going to drive prices down longer and more than people think possible.
China's economic slowdown, how's that going to affect the rest of us?
Well, it's pretty significant because, of course, in the last, again, this period I'm describing from the Great Recession to, say, this year, the central banks of the world were the perpetual backstoppers. They no longer have that option or luxury because they now have inflation in the system, right? So this concoction of fiscal and monetary stimulants thrown at it worldwide really led to this, you know, balloon in inflation in the cost of living. And that is now the bogey, right? That's now the thing that everybody's fixated on killing. So at the cost of these asset bubbles. So before that, they never had as they saw it, there was never any sort of legitimate excuse to burst these asset bubbles and very speculative behaviors in the general public because, you know, they were keeping money really cheap and there didn't seem to be any cost to that or any downside to that. Of course, the asset bubbles that are imploding now are the cost and people are going to bear that cost, but that's typical of human behavior. So anyway, the process was central banks had the, you know, freedom to do whatever, and politicians loved it because it made it look like things were expanding under their watch. Meanwhile, it was just leverage, right? So anyway, that was going on at the same time as every time that the economy came to a slowdown, China had this huge cash reserve from the decade before that, when they were the hardware, or they were the manufacturing hub for the world. They brought in a whole bunch of cash through their export machine in the decade between 2000 and 2010, and then they were redeploying that cash, recircling that cash back into their own economy, into the property sector primarily, into development, investment, manufacturing, infrastructure at home. And that kept a bid under things like commodity prices. That kept a bid under all kinds of goods in the world, while they were feeding that machine with their own credit machine, like recycling, again, levering up their economy. But what's happened in the last, since COVID hit, is they've had this chronic resurgence of COVID cases, at the same time as there's a lot of, disintegration of this globalization concept, and there's a great acrimony now developing between China and places like the United States, where there was this sort of virtuous circle on the way up, and now it's going in the opposite direction in terms of they no longer want to import everything from China. They want to have, reshoring of manufacturing. There's a lot of suspicion and dispute that's going on, and that's been made worse, frankly, with the Russians' invasion of Ukraine, because, as you know, China and Russia have a sort of an alliance there that has made the rest of the world more suspicious, etc. So, All to say that China is no longer the backer, and they also have a property bubble bursting at home, which was 30% of their GDP growth in the past number of years was coming from that levering up in the property sector, building unlimited amounts of apartment buildings and condos, selling them to the regular population who couldn't afford to live in them in many cases, but who were borrowing, getting loans, buying them, hoping they could rent them out long enough to pay it down and acquire some equity. So, of course, their property market has already been falling, actual outright decline in prices for the past couple of years, and their economy has been suffering as they're trying to pivot away from just, build at any cost, at the same time that you have this COVID resurgence continuing. So the COVID cases in China, and there's this, everyone's sort of conditioned to think, oh, China will save us. They always have. No, actually, they only did that for about a decade when they had the actual money room and ability to keep it up. What you're seeing now is that the COVID cases in China, for example, are back to the highest they've been since April. And so every time someone says, oh, they're going to loosen their lockdown policy, they're going to free up the economy, they're going to pump in a bunch more stimulus, this is the great hope in the West, right, that they will, it's just like the cavalry will come riding to our rescue again, as they have several times in the preceding decade. But we're in a fundamentally different dynamic now. Like, China's producer price index fell in October. It's the first negative decline in almost 2 years. In terms of, so they're not only are they already seeing this deflation in property and housing, in a massive slowdown in their economy, which is a new normal level, by the way. It's not a periodic cyclical decline. It's a secular shift from the hypergrowth they had in the prior period. And so now, at the same time, they're selling less to the world. They're having to deal with very high debt levels at home. It's really a whole new world. And so China is no longer going to be able to bail out the economy globally with its demand. Neither will it bail out commodities, to keep their prices and say, indefinitely high. So we're really in a massive shift. And the question is, who's going to save us now? If it's not central banks, if it's not China riding to the rescue, Japan, Lord knows, is in no condition to do it. Europe's in a major recession with a whole bunch of strife in all sorts of different sectors. So there's no clear person here, other than, the U.S. is the least dirty shirt in this environment, and they too are heading into a major recession and a protectionism of wanting to try and protect their own manufacturing sector and rebuild it and that sort of thing. So it's a good old-fashioned bear market, Jim. It's not like anything people saw in 2020. It's a major recession. It's not even a quick jump down like, you know, people thought in 2007-9, quick down and back up. Even though that was the Great Recession, it sort of recovered relatively quickly with all the stimulus tricks that were thrown at it. I think, you know, typically real estate downturns lead to worst recessions, and we haven't had one like that since the early sort of in 1980 and 1990 at the start. We saw another one. We had a kind of a couple of good years of really stagnant and negative growth in the world economy and a bunch of deflation in asset prices. And ultimately, I think that's going to be the cure for the disease that has plagued us for the past number of years. It will restore affordability. It will bring back things like math skills being of value in the investment world. And people will be less inclined to throw things around like a drunken sailor. So ultimately that's good, but getting from here to there, there's a lot of pain to go around.
Danielle, any advice for people right now who might be late to the game, or are people still in denial that this is a bear market?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we did see some selling of the ETFs, equity ETFs, from the general public in the most recent, just in the last week. But up until this point, we've still had no capitulation selling. We still have, more than 60%, generally speaking, of allocations are towards equities. Many people have had upwards to 100% of equities in their retirement savings accounts, Jim. So those are the people that are seeing such a dramatic drop here. Just the average base mark, pension ETFs, that sort of thing, are off sort of 15% in the last year. But the average portfolio is down more than about 25%. So I guess, I know I was saying before all this happened, you should use low interest rates to get out of debt, not get into debt. So if people didn't do that, it's going to be really hard for them now. There's a huge amount of people that are extending the amortization of their mortgages, which is amazing. Like, amortizations over 30 years, right, is 25% of bank mortgages in Canada right now, which is a double in the past few months, because most typical mortgages were usually 25 years and less. Now they're, 25% or over 30 years. So certainly some people are going about this by extending the amortization of their mortgage to try and lower their payments. And if they have that room, then that might be a strategy. But if they are over levered, they shouldn't have all their life savings in the really risky, equities, cryptos, all this stuff that people have been throwing money into. They should have some cash. They should have some government bonds, which are, by the way, one of the only asset classes that looks like it's probably bottomed in terms of historical moves and, presenting the best value it has in 70 years. So there's yields today that you can get on the safest credits, which is above 4%. So there is a place that people can put money. GICs at the bank are now paying more than 4% for 1 and 2 year terms. So there are safe places people can put cash, but they have to understand this new dynamic. And if they're still in the buy and hold mentality, then they better be prepared to hold for the next decade. Because the thing is that in these good old-fashioned bear markets, where recessions can last a couple of years and bear markets can fall 50% and stay there for several years before they start to recover, you better make sure that whatever you're doing today, you can survive that kind of a stress period. So that means, make sure your payments are well within your means. If you have a bunch of leverage that could create a problem in that scenario, now is still not too late to pay that down. Extend your payments, curtail your spending where possible. Try and be smart and efficient. Don't be thinking that, that everything's a buying opportunity and you keep doubling down on the things that are falling. That's not the way to survive this period.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council, Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
comments made on HowStreet.com Radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.